to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Branson, and we'll start our program with Leanne Harder, bringing us the monthly Story County Report.
Well, hi, Susan. I just want to start with some good news. Public access to Story County buildings resumed last week, October 5th, and Story County buildings had been open behind closed doors. We've been conducting government as normal, but the public access did resume last Monday, October 5th, to the Story County Administration Building and the Story County Secondary Roads County Engineer's Office, both in Nevada. If you do need to visit the offices of the recorder or the treasurer in person, however, both of them are located in the administration building, you must first schedule an appointment. You can visit Story County's website, and there's a schedule an appointment tab. It's a red box you'll see, and it takes you to a third-party software that allows you to schedule a meeting. In-person services also resumed at the Story County Justice Center in Nevada. Services available at the Human Service Center in Ames continue to be available by phone, email, and by appointment, as public access to that building still remains limited. The Story County Animal Shelter continues to do adoptions on approved applications by appointment and does encourage people to call the animal shelter. They are at 382-3338 with any and all questions. And then last, Story County Conservation Parks and offices are open, but indoor activities have not yet resumed. Anyone entering county buildings is required to wear a face covering and practice social distancing. For those who cannot wear a face covering due to health conditions, we do encourage you to access all services from the safety of your home through the methods. You can use email, you can call the departments, you can use snail mail, there's drop boxes. If you go to the county's website, which is www.storycountyiowa.gov, there's contact phone numbers for all the offices and departments within Story County. Story County's top priority remains the safety of employees and the public. The county will continue to evaluate operations and adjust services and safety measures as needed. And then over the weekend, we did hear the unfortunate news, though, that the treasurer's office is temporarily closed due to a COVID-19 positive. It is closed until further notice due to a case within the team of the treasurer's office. At this time, appointments are not being accepted until we can better assess the situation. I did speak with Treasurer Ted Rasmussen, and he did indicate that you should be able to schedule appointments online beginning Wednesday evening, but check our website and see if that is still able to occur. We apologize that we cannot answer phones or email until we're back in the office. Treasurer's office does share that message and does ask me to thank you for your patience as we work through protocols to ensure we provide everyone a safe environment in which to complete county business. So again, check the county's website for the most up-to-date information on that matter. Just some important information on the November 3rd, 2020 general election. Start by going to Story County's website, select the auditor's office, and look on elections. And there's a tab just for the general election. But in-person voting did begin Monday, October 5th. It's available until 5 p.m. on Monday, November 2nd. Absentee voting in the administration building will also occur on Saturday, October 24th, and then the following Saturday, October 31st, both those days from 8 a.m. till 5 p.m. All voting does occur on the main floor of the administration building, which is at 906th Street. So when you come in our main doors, we ask you to enter the doors on the right-hand side. They're marked entrance, and then the left-hand side is exit. You come in those doors, you stay on that level, and you follow the red arrows and the blue circles all the way back to the voting. Due to some construction that remains on city streets in Nevada, there is some limited access to our main parking lot. 6th Street is now open, but J Avenue remains closed, so you need to enter from 6th Street. And unless otherwise noted, the administration building will continue to be open for in-person absentee voting from Monday through Friday. Satellite voting is starting too. Those locations and the schedule are available by checking Story County's website. And just a reminder, as of June 30th, 2020, pre-registered voters must present identification prior to voting absentee in person. Identification requirements are the same as those for pre-registered voters voting on Election Day. It's highly recommended that unregistered voters bring both proof of identification and a proof of residency with them, regardless of the date. So if you did submit a request for absentee ballot, those went out by mail. The first day was last Friday, October 5th. The last day to request a mail ballot is Saturday, October 24th. And on the request form, mark general under the type of election and fill in the election date 11/03 of 2020 in the proper area. And if you need to return your absentee ballot, you can do it by mail with the return envelope provided with prepaid postage. That envelope must be postmarked no later than Monday, November 2nd, and received in the auditor's office by Monday, November 9th. You can also deliver your ballot in person to the auditor's office up until 9 p.m. on Election Day. And there are ballot drop boxes in the front of the administration building. Do note, though, you cannot drop off a completed ballot at usual polling places on Election Day. And then you can also return your mail ballot to any satellite voting location, however. Switching gears a little bit, following up on the August 10th, 2020 derecho event, FEMA individual assistance is available for residents of Story County. Story County qualified for that program on September 2nd. Residents do have until November 2nd to apply for FEMA individual assistance. There's a disaster recovery center in Ames at River Valley Park. If you have any questions on the FEMA individual assistance program, you go to www.disasterassistance.gov. Or you can go to Story County's website, and they have a link to Story County Derecho Storm Information page. Still, following up on the derecho, the debris drop-off site for unincorporated residents is still open. It was open a few weeks ago, and it's for yard waste and vegetative storm debris from that storm event. Site for organic storm debris only, no root balls. And if it's in yard waste bags, it cannot be accepted. It's a self-haul drop-off only. It's located at 60016 160th Street, so southeast of Roland. You go to the southeast corner of the intersection of 600th Avenue and 160th Street. It's open Monday through Wednesdays from 12 noon to 4 p.m., and then again on Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. It will remain open until October 31st of this month, the end of this month. Staff cannot help unload debris. The dumping of non-yard waste debris outside of those set hours is considered illegal dumping. And if you do have any questions, call Planning and Development at 382-7245, or again, visit our website. Once that date happens and is over with, the no-charge yard waste days are set for fall. During the fall, no-charge yard waste days planned in October and November. Scheduled Saturdays, October 31st, November 7th, November 21st, the 28th, and they are at Green for You at 400 Friel Drive in Ames, and those hours are 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Story County Recorder's Office has some news to share with the administration building once again open to the public. They are now accepting passport applications by appointment only. Again, you go to the county's website to make that appointment. They are also accepting applications for vital records, marriage applications, and DNR transactions. So call their office at 515-382-7230 to make sure you have everything you might need for that upcoming appointment. A final reminder, because next time I visit you, the date will have gone by. The U.S. Census is still trying to get the self-responses and self-enumeration answers. They have kept it open until October 31st of 2020. So if you still have not responded to your census, please do so. It is important for the future of Story County and of all of our communities. If you have questions, go to 2020census.gov. I did want to note that the state fire marshal has approved a request from the fire chiefs in Story County to institute a burn ban for all of Story County, effective as of today at 9 a.m. until further notice. As we all know, conditions are dangerously dry and there's a risk that any burning could cause a significant fire. This means any open burning is prohibited unless it's specifically permitted by Iowa Code Section 100.40 subsection 3. With that, I do want to let you know, if you have any questions, sign up for Notify Me. How you reach us, check us out on social media. We have Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The weekly board meetings of the Board of Supervisors are up on the YouTube channel, so you can follow that. They're not live, they're rebroadcast, though. And you can contact me. I'm Leanne Harter at lharter@storycountyiowa.gov. My phone number is 515-382-7247. And one last plug for our county website. It's www.storycountyiowa.gov. And thank you, Susan, for letting me come here every month and share all the information we have at Story County.
And thank you, Leanne, for your dedication in bringing your report to us every month. Some of our listeners may remember the morning that your house was hit by lightning, but you still drove over from Nevada to deliver your report on Local Talk. In your honor, and to transition to the rest of our program about voting, I'll play a patriotic song by the U.S. Army Band.
All right, my whip down to camp along with Captain Gooden, and there we saw the men and boys as thick as hasty pudding.
Yankee Doodle, keep it up. Yankee Doodle, daddy. Find the music and the step, and with the girls be handy.
And there was General Washington upon a slapping stallion, of giving orders to his men. I guess there was a million.
Yankee Doodle, keep it up. Yankee Doodle, dandy. Find the music and the step, and with the girls be handy.
In case you just tuned in, you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where you've just heard Leanne Harter with the Story County Report, providing us with a lot of practical information about voting and staying safe in an age of COVID-19, as well as dealing with natural disasters such as the derecho and prairie fires. The rest of our program will deal with the history of how the right to vote has been expanded throughout American history. Our next guest will be Brian Benkin, Associate Professor of History and U.S. Latino and Latina Studies Program at ISU, with an appointment in the African and African American Studies Program. The Ames League of Women Voters hosted him at a forum on August 20th for his talk on disenfranchisement, voting rights, and the suffrage. League President Linda Hagedorn provided the introduction.
We are very honored to have Dr. Benkin be our speaker. The title of his presentation is Disenfranchisement, Voting Rights, and the Suffrage.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for the introduction and for having me and inviting me to be a part of the League of Women Voters program. Once again, this is my second time speaking for the League, and so I'm really happy to be back. I guess the thing I would like to start off with is just by noting kind of the title. If we look at voting rights in the United States in a lot of different ways, it's much more common to see disfranchisement at work than it is to actually see the expansion of the suffrage. And so that's really what I'm going to be talking about. That's really sort of the point, I guess, or the argument, going back to the founding of the country, the long history of what voting rights and what disfranchisement actually look like. And so we'll be starting with white male suffrage. We'll be getting into the enfranchisement and then the disfranchisement of Black male voters. I also like to make sure I include Latino folks in this discussion as well, because I think if we just look at, for example, Black and white voters, we kind of miss part of the big picture in the ways in which other ethnic communities were discriminated against and didn't have their rights. Obviously, in the expanding voting rights section, we have women's suffrage, which I'll be looking at. And after that, in particular, with the Voting Rights Act, which is after the 15th Amendment, is probably the single biggest expansion of voting rights in the United States. And then one of the other things that I think is really interesting that comes out of the 60s and 70s is third-party politics. And so the politics, if you will, of activist groups and the way in which they challenge the two-party system by developing their own parties. And then finally, just to give everyone a sense with this part of it, where we are today and how things like gerrymandering and voter ID, mail-in voting and things of that nature, absentee voting, really are impacting voters today. Think of the United States as this nation conceived of in liberty and democracy as being a really core part of it. In fact, voting was incredibly limited early on in American history. So just to give you a couple of quick examples, under the original Articles of Confederation, there were basically very few voting rights for the American people. And it's kind of interesting to read through the Articles of Confederation, because certainly a lot of the structures of government that we're kind of used to are there, but very little about voting. Now, as we all know, the Articles of Confederation didn't last very long. They were replaced by the Constitution fairly quickly. And the Constitution certainly expanded voting rights, but it left it to states to determine who could vote. And most states, what they decided to do is allow only white men to vote. But of course, it's more specific than that. It's not just white men, it's white men who owned property, in this particular sense, land, and also what they called at the time real assets. We still call it this today, but real assets. And what real assets meant is other pieces of property beyond land that were sufficient enough for taxation by the state. You could own property that was not very valuable, that didn't, you don't have a lot of wealth to your name. It wasn't worth taxing by the state, and so they wouldn't tax it. I mean, that's how states established voting after the Constitution. You know, I think it's kind of interesting when you really look back at this, because the number of people that were, and let's be very clear, right? The number of white men who were allowed to vote was incredibly small. I would also remind everyone that at that particular time, this would have been again in the late 1700s and into the early 1800s, white was a much more limited category. So it would be possible. It would be possible, let's say, if you were French or of German extraction or whatever, if you own property and assets, to acquire the right to vote. But for the most part, white meant Anglo-Saxon, it meant English people. And so even in that sort of terminology, you have a very limiting way in which people can vote. And then when you add the property stuff to it, what it ends up meaning is that in most states, it's several hundred people who are able to vote. And even that, if you think about it, like direct elections are not what they are today. They had the power to vote for their state legislators, and they had the power to vote for members of the US House. But the state legislature actually chose who would go to serve the state in the Senate. So even when you're a white male who owned property, what you were actually able to vote for was fairly limited. Now, this does change in the 1830s. Andrew Jackson, I think many of us know, he inaugurated something today that we refer to as Jacksonian democracy. And Jacksonian democracy is perhaps much closer to how we might understand the suffrage today, still limited, of course, to white men. Jackson's idea was to eliminate those property qualifications for voting. So all white men would be able to vote. And, you know, he did this in part because he knew it would help him win the election. It was still up to the states, like as a presidential candidate or as president himself, he doesn't necessarily have the power to tell the states, you know, we're going to change the way you do voting. But his ideas were very influential. And what ended up happening is a lot of the original, you know, so-called Eastern states, if you will, a lot of those states began to change their voting policies. And then a lot of the newer Western states that were receiving statehood, you know, throughout the 1820s, 1830s, they actually established, you know, their own voting rights that eliminated those property qualifications. And so this is often termed universal male suffrage. Even that terminology, of course, is incredibly problematic. It would be better to refer to it as universal white male suffrage.
Because, of course, if you were a man of color, if you were a black person, then more than likely you were an enslaved person. And if you weren't an enslaved person, you still really weren't considered a part of the United States. And you obviously wouldn't have been considered white. And so you couldn't have voted either. But this actually changes. Like we go from several hundred people per state who can vote to tens of thousands. And so that expansion is significant. It's just, of course, limited to one singular group of people. There are these expansions of voting rights, of the suffrage. They're really every few decades, and they extend voting rights to new groups of people, but they still do it in this kind of partial piecemeal fashion. So it's an expansion, but it's still kind of like a limited expansion. So after the Civil War, the Congress passed new what are called Reconstruction Era Amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And the 15th Amendment, I think many of us know, was the one that extended voting rights to black men. Now, this is, of course, the time during Reconstruction where the United States is not only trying to rebuild itself, but trying to basically figure out how to incorporate, approximately 4 million newly free people into the body politic of the United States. And there was a lot of talk about just extending voting rights to black people in general, but that created a little bit of a conundrum, because if you do that, then that means you're also giving black women the right to vote. And of course, there was a lot of furor and hubbub about extending women the right to vote and who should go first and, should black women get it before white women and so on and so forth. And so what the 15th Amendment does is it basically enshrines, now this is where you get to a more universal male suffrage. It gives voting rights, it enshrines voting rights for black people. And that's, that's important, right? Because African-Americans, they use those rights. We have a number of really famous depictions showing black men voting. So African-Americans, they understand very early on that there are a couple of things that are going to help them not just have freedom, but actually hold it and secure it, right? To actually keep it safe. And voting is one of those. So the idea of land being tied to voting, even though it goes away as kind of a legal principle, it's still one that's very popular. And so black folks, they have ideas about land ownership and voting as ways to be able to protect their rights and the community. Black men and black people more generally understood just how important the vote was, and they cherished it and they exercised it quite vigorously. But I want to remind everyone again, here we have another expansion of voting rights that still has an incredible number of limitations on it, because it's extended to only one group of people, and amongst that group only, if you will, half of the of the population. So one of the things that we know that happens during Reconstruction and afterwards is there is an incredible amount of angst amongst white people in general and white leaders very specifically about black people exercising their rights to vote. And it's one of the reasons, for example, why we get the first Ku Klux Klan. It's one of the reasons why there's so much widespread violence during the Reconstruction era, is literally to stop people from exercising their freedoms. And again, to be very specific, to stop black people from exercising their freedoms. There are a ton of different drawings and cartoons and whatnot out there that describe these things. These two were some of the more interesting, I think, both of, because they're both depicting people with like weapons and guns. And so there's a lot of intimidation. I'll just hold that word there for a second, because we're going to come back to it. There's a lot of intimidation, but there's also something else going on. And you can see that in the picture on the left-hand side of your screen. It's two white men holding guns to a black man. And if you're able to read the text down at the bottom, what it says is, of course, he wants to vote the Democratic ticket. Now, I highlight this because more than likely, that's not the case. What they're really saying here is that this man is going to vote, but because they have guns on him and he's fearful, he's going to be forced to vote for the Democratic ticket. And this is at a time where the Democratic Party is, there's no nice way around it, right? It is the party of white supremacy. It is the party of racism and Jim Crow, and it's the party that is supporting these different disfranchisement measures. The vast majority of Black people in the United States, and especially those in the South, would have voted the Republican ticket. You know, they would have voted for the party of Lincoln and done so for obvious reasons. So what they're saying here, I think is interesting, is like this man is going to get to vote, but he's not going to get to vote for who he wants to vote for. More than likely, they're going to force him to vote for the Democratic candidate. And obviously that's not like, that's not freedom, right? That's not a choice or an actual right at this particular point. But, you know, this individual has no choice. He's being forced to do what these men with guns want him to do. One of the things that I like to emphasize in talks like this, and I teach on this at Iowa State, is this kind of intimidation. It's fairly universal, and the level of violence, you know, we're talking about people being beaten, shot. We're talking about people, you know, being lynched for exercising their rights. So intimidation is rampant. But it doesn't have to be those things. You know, all it really has to be is like a sheriff, for example, standing outside of the polling place. And, you know, a lot of times Black people are going to understand, I'm kind of taking my life into my own hands if I try to go in here and vote. And so I'm just going to turn around and walk the other way, excuse me. So intimidation is really, really important to understand. It's also something that affects a lot of other groups. So you're going to hear me reference it once again. One of the things I like to teach my students, and that, you know, I'd like for you all to know today as well, is the level of things that Southern governments especially did to prevent Black men from voting. I mean, there are so many different things that these governments do. I mean, it actually kind of boggles the mind how creative these governments are, and the way people who run them, how creative they are in developing these different disfranchisement strategies. And in fact, it shows you something about like racist power or how racism is institutionalized, but it also shows you something about how the vote is a way in which people exercise power. And if you can prevent people from doing that, you can basically cripple them and make them defenseless. The other thing I would say is a lot of times we're taught to think of racist people as like, you know, ignorant, they haven't been educated right, or they grew up in the, whatever, you know, whatever the thinking is. In fact, what I would argue in some of these cases of how disfranchisement works, and again, especially for Black people and their racism, in fact, was incredibly ingenious. There is a genius that goes behind it. Because if you understand, if you're an attorney, for example, and you understand how the law works and you know how to make the law work for you, then you can hold power over people. And that's what we see with a lot of these disfranchisement measures. So, again, I have a slew of these disfranchisement measures. The first one I'm going to talk about is what's called the multiple ballot. And actually, if you'll recall the scenes of Black men voting before, you kind of got a sense of this in that there are these multiple jars that you can put your ballot into. The multiple ballot would be similar to what we have today. So if you're familiar with how you go and vote, and maybe you're voting, if it's a presidential election, you're voting for president, you're maybe voting for a senator or a congressional candidate, there are judges, there are people for the hospital district. If there are any kind of like amendments, any kind of other issues they put on the ballot, you know, you have to check all those boxes. Back in the day, multiple ballots were literally multiple ballots, right? So if there were 15 things to vote on, you would have to have 15 different ballots. And each one of those ballots had to be filled out perfectly. And if it wasn't filled out perfectly, if there was any kind of mistake, and this is part of the way you can see how disfranchisement works more easily. You know, I turn in my ballot and it's perfectly fine, but if I happen to be Black, somebody made a little tear on it or made a little mark, and now it's, you know, now it's disqualified and it goes away. But the idea of multiple ballots, you know, can be very confusing. I mean, how many of us have been confused when we've gone to vote and there are just so many different things to vote for and it gets confusing? So imagine having to do that on individual ballots. It gets incredibly confusing. And this becomes popular in Reconstruction and lasts for a couple of decades. It's done at the time because Southern governments that do these things, they know that Black people are basically a semi-literate population. They know the African-American community had been deprived in education. In many cases, people were only just getting education. And so they wouldn't be able to understand maybe or notice if they made a mistake or something like that. So in addition to the multiple ballots, you have multiple ballot boxes. And what this means is if there were 15 different ballots for 15 different races or issues or whatever it might be, you had to place each ballot in the appropriate slot, the appropriate box. And again, Southern governments understand this. Southern leaders understand this. If you're a newly freed person and you don't know how to read or write, or you're just learning how to read or write, not only is filling out the ballot difficult, but then figuring out which ballot box it actually goes into is equally different. If you add what's next, it becomes even more difficult. So obviously one of the huge expansions in voting comes after the passage of the 19th Amendment. I want to first make sure that we're all clear, and I know that the League of Women Voters is clear on this, but I think because of the fact that it happens in the 20th century, you know, we forget that the women's right movement or women suffrage, as they called back in the day, this really began in the 19th century, and so it has a much longer history. Black women, especially, they did not feel welcomed in many of the more prominent national voting groups. So they founded their own, and they were quite fearful, and I would say rightfully so. They were quite fearful. Either the rhetoric they heard or the actions that they saw would actually lead not to the enfranchisement of Black female voters, but in fact their disfranchisement. And what we know, of course, about voting in the South is that, the amendment was ratified. It was incredibly important, but Black women in the South were not protected. A national amendment could not protect their right to vote. And so much like Black men, they were disfranchised in a very similar way. Whiteness is normalized in the suffrage movement. And so I think a lot of times because of that, we forget or even exclude the accomplishments and or the participation of other groups. And so this is just an example of one. This is a group of Mexican American suffragists in New Mexico. This is another way in which you can see how the movement itself was segregated. Different groups and different communities, different ethno-racial communities, would found their own suffrage organizations, and they would push for the vote in their own way. Of course, we know, that the amendment was successful. This, much like I mentioned with the 15th Amendment, is one of the most consequential and important expansions of voting rights in the United States. And, I think we have to always recognize that. We have to recognize how important it was, even though at the same time we have to recognize that while it was for quote-unquote women, it did not affect or grant rights to all women equally. So there are some other, I want to make clear, there's some other expansions of voting rights that occur, between 1920 and 1965. They have an important impact. They don't affect, if you will, that many people. And so one of the things that happens is we get some immigration reforms in the 1950s that allow groups that previously had been denied citizenship, in particular Chinese immigrants, allows those individuals to become citizens. And with that, they're able to, to be able to vote. Of course, the two most monumental civil rights voting reforms are the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. We, of course, don't oftentimes think of the Civil Rights Act as a voting measure. However, there is some important voting legislation as a part of that. The problem with it is it didn't have any teeth. It didn't have any mechanisms by which the government could enforce it. And they found very quickly that Southern states would just go around it. And so that's why we get the Voting Rights Act, which basically undoes all of the disfranchisement measures that weren't already undone, in particular the poll tax. But the big thing it does is it actually puts power behind the federal government to be able to monitor elections in the South. I put these in here basically chronologically. So we have multiple ballots and ballot boxes and secret ballots, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. We have the generation of the literacy test and its usage, 1880s, 1890s, into the early 20th century. Same thing with the grandfather clause, I should say. And then the poll tax, turn of the century. And then later on in roughly the 19-teens, the creation of the all-white Democratic primary. This is one of the things that a lot of people in my home state of Texas are a little ashamed about, because it originated there. And basically what each one of these does is not only kind of reinforce each other, but once you have, let's say, the grandfather clause or the literacy test be declared unconstitutional, then folks are like, oh, snap, we need to find other ways to disfranchise people. And so you get the poll tax or you get the all-white Democratic primary. The way the all-white Democratic primary worked is it limited voting in the Democratic primary and in state Democratic primaries to only white people. What that ensured is that the most segregationist, racist candidate would always be the one that was chosen. There were Black people that wanted to vote in the primary. What they found is that, you know, not only could not vote, they were prevented from voting, but they found, of course, that the candidate that the white folks in the party were choosing was the most racist candidate, so they wouldn't want to vote for that person anyway. The way this gets to be disfranchisement is if you can't vote in the primary, you don't get to pick, for example, who the gubernatorial nominee is going to be. And so in a state like Texas or in a lot of other southern states where the Democratic Party is the, you know, is the main party, Republican Party is always an incredibly small minority party in most southern states, the Democratic candidate that they pick is almost universally going to be the one that wins. You don't have a choice in who's getting picked. And then the person that the primary picks is the person that is going to win the election. And so that's how it's disfranchisement, because if your vote has no real meaningful power and the primary is actually deciding who is going to be the winner of the election, then your vote is nullified. And then to wrap things up, we're going to go to the very last one. And I'm going back to, I said I would come back to intimidation. I want you to understand, especially if you're a Black person, how intimidating voting was and how white people took advantage of that by using methods that were designed to intimidate you. So we saw the picture of people with guns. As I said before, you know, they could post a sheriff. A lot of times they would post, there'd be an actual Klansman outside of a polling place. In many communities, it got to the point where voting basically meant taking your life into your own hands. And, you know, for a lot of people, of course, it's just not worth it. And I think we know, like, even in the 50s and the 60s, when the civil rights movement is focusing on voting and they're trying to get people to go and register to vote, that the people who attempted to do that were getting beaten down. They were getting arrested. They were getting, you know, that the registrar, for example, was allowed to carry a gun. And so, you know, you'd have the registrar, for example, brandishing a weapon at you if you went to try to vote. I'm going to add, there's a whole lot of other trickery that goes on. I probably spent enough time on this, but, you know, I think it's really important for us to understand. And this is trickery that we still see going on periodically today. So a lot of times Southern communities would publicize the wrong voting date. And they would do that, of course, on purpose. They'd say, don't forget to vote on November the 9th, when the election was going to be on the 6th. We actually have seen that happen in presidential elections, the past couple of election cycles in places like North Carolina. They would move polling places pretty frequently. And so if you knew where you were going and then suddenly it's not there, where do I go? And then there's no instruction. A lot of times Southern communities would place polling places only, let's say, on the white side of town, only within white communities. And Black people understood that transgressing that boundary into the white community was itself dangerous. So there's just like a scad of stuff, a slew, if you will, of mechanisms that Southern communities use. And the last thing that I'll say about this, there are only a handful of these measures that I'm talking about were exclusively designed to impact Black people. Certainly the grandfather clause was, in a lot of ways the Democratic primary was, a lot of the intimidation that I'm talking about was directed almost exclusively at Black voters. But all of the other things impacted, you know, every different group and community, you know, in the South and elsewhere. So the poll tax is a really good example of this. The poll tax is not about race, it's about economics. So if you're a poor white voter and you can't go, you know, you can't go and afford that $2 poll tax, you don't get to vote. And again, this is part of the way that Southern leaders and especially Southern elites actually design these things. So we think about it exclusively a lot of times as like disfranchisement of African Americans. But if you were poorly educated, then the literacy test, and you're white, I should say, the literacy test is going to hamper your ability to vote. If you're not well educated and you're white, you know, multiple ballots and multiple ballot boxes and secret ballots are going to impact your ability to vote. And white leaders knew that as well. They're, you know, so there's a clear race element in all of this, but there's also a clear class element too. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that. So when we talk about Latino law folks, things are a little bit different. Mainly Mexican origin people in the United States until about the mid 20th century, when greater immigration waves from places like Cuba or Puerto Rico or from Central America became much more common. Mexican Americans are, of course, the largest portion of the Latino population. They're about over 60% of that population. But back, let's say, the 1850s to the 1900s, you know, they would have been close to like 96, 98%. So mainly Mexican American people. So it's one of the ways we can see not only maybe how voting rights were kind of so-called extended, but also citizenship. And obviously voting is tied very closely to citizenship. So via what's known as the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which brought an end to the Mexican-American War in 1848, that treaty basically granted to Mexican people living in the United States at that particular time citizenship. One of the things that's kind of interesting about this treaty, and I'll just say that this is a quick aside, is the way in which it's written. It actually applies to Mexican people who come after, you know, after the treaty is written. And so it's maybe much more universal than we might think. But it extended citizenship to Mexican people, and through that extended voting to Mexican people. Now, it doesn't always, of course, work out like that, right? So most Mexican Americans, you know, until really the civil rights era, were treated as second class citizens. They were segregated and Jim Crowed in much the same way that African Americans were. And so their treatment, where we're talking about voting, is a little bit different. And it's actually closer to the picture that I showed you of the, you know, the individual having the guns pointed at him and he's going to go vote for the Democratic ticket. There's a very famous saying in the Mexican American community that saying is, while Blacks were not allowed to vote, Mexican Americans were voted. And what that means is that they had no choice. So what would happen, and this was particularly egregious in kind of South and South Central and Southwest Texas, but it would also happen across the Southwest. What would happen is, let's say a farm owner would gather all of his Mexican workers together and load them up, let's say in a truck, and take them down to the polling place and say, if you want to keep your job, go in and pull the lever for candidate A. And of course, those individuals wanted to keep their jobs, and so they would go and pull the candidate for candidate A. And candidate A was almost universally, you know, again, the most racist, white supremacist candidate there was. And, you know, my assumption, much like the African American community, is that is not the choice that most Mexican origin people would make in their voting, but they were forced to do that. Again, you can kind of see the economic means at work there because they needed a job. In other cases, you know, you would have examples where people would be bought off. You know, they get bought off with you know, with actual cash money or with food or with alcohol, things of that nature. And, you know, if you want this meal, I know you're hungry, go in and pull a lever for candidate A. Only Puerto Rican people have what I'm calling here limited voting rights. Puerto Ricans were granted U.S. citizenship in 1917, but they were a fairly small portion of the U.S. population, and they really only had voting rights if they lived in the continental United States. And this is really still pretty well and true today. So Puerto Ricans who live in, you know, on the island of Puerto Rico, they actually have very few voting rights in the United States government. If, however, you live, and a lot of folks at the time lived in New York City, if you lived in New York City, there was, you know, you had much more of the ability to go and vote. There was much in a place like New York, right? It's not that there isn't racism or segregation there. It's just not of the same kind of quality, if you will, of what you would find in the South. And so, you know, if you were Puerto Rican, possibly you could go and vote.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've just heard selections from a forum titled Disenfranchisement, Voting Rights, and the Suffrage by Brian Behnken, delivered on August 20th for the Ames League of Women Voters Forum. To bring this subject into the 21st century, we have Veronica Larson Fowler, Communications Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, of Iowa, to talk with us about the most recent extension of the suffrage to people convicted of felonies. In the interest of self-disclosure, KHOI is airing a public service announcement about this issue that is paid for by the ACLU of Iowa, but we requested this interview and are not being paid for it. Thanks for being with us today, Veronica. Let's start with a little history. Was there ever a time before Governor Reynolds' recent executive order number 7 that people convicted of felonies could vote in Iowa?
Yes, absolutely. Under Governor Culver and Governor Vilsack, actually Governor Vilsack signed an executive order, and tens of thousands of people in Iowa who previously couldn't vote because of a conviction. Not only Governor Culver also had an executive order. Well, Governor Branstad, when he took office, one of the very first things he did was to issue an executive order that stripped people of the right to vote, not only for felonies, but even aggravated misdemeanors, which is simply, it could be a barroom brawl. They were stripped for life of their right to vote. And Iowa became one of a handful of states in the country that had the harshest laws that disenfranchised people after a criminal conviction. Through Iowa Supreme Court decisions, that was eventually changed, and people with aggravated misdemeanors could vote, and that restored the vote to tens of thousands of Iowans. And then recently, of course, Governor Reynolds signed an executive order that said that people with felony convictions could vote after they're done with the terms of their parole, probation, special sentences, and excluded anyone who had a conviction under Iowa Code 707, which covers homicides like vehicular homicide, involuntary manslaughter, and some others. You do not have to have paid off restitution fees or fines, which is good because your right to vote should not be dependent on how much money you have.
So now the problem is simply with people knowing that they do have rights. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly one of the challenges, but there's still more work to be done. We appreciate Governor Reynolds's executive order, especially since the Iowa legislature failed to act on it. So we appreciate that, but we feel that you should never lose your right to vote, that it is a fundamental right, just like free speech and due process. Therefore, you should never have it taken away. You should be able to vote while you're in jail, while you're in prison. You shouldn't have to serve the terms of your probation, parole, and things like that. And so that's what we're working for. We are also working for a permanent fix to this problem in our state. Governor Reynolds' executive order was a temporary fix because another governor can come along and reverse it or change it. And so what we would like to do is amend the Iowa Constitution to enshrine voting rights in the Constitution and specify that you can vote after a felony conviction. With some litigation that the ACLU has brought, we brought this case before the Iowa Supreme Court to try to restore voting rights for people with felony convictions that way. And the Supreme Court basically demurred and said, this isn't for us to decide. The way we read the Iowa Constitution, it is not especially clear. So this is a legislative fix. And so that's what we're doing. We are trying to get legislation pushed through the Iowa legislature, and that's a heavy lift. You need to have a bill pass two consecutive general assemblies, and then it's taken to a vote of the people. You need to register to vote, and at the polls, you will need to present some voter ID, and that can take several forms. If you have a valid Iowa driver's license or government non-operator ID, you're fine. Especially if it has your address on it, current address, of course, but people who have been recently incarcerated or coming out of a felony conviction often have had a lot of disruption in their lives. So they may or may not have driver's license. They may or may not have a passport. They may or may not have other forms of ID that you can present are things like a recent utility bill that has your address on it, the residence of where you now live. You know, if you have been recently incarcerated, you may or may not have those things. I would encourage anyone who has any questions about this to please go to our website, www.youcanvoteiowa.org. And again, that's www.youcanvoteiowa, all one word, all lowercase, .org.
Is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the peoples, places, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today, and with me have been Leanne Harter, Linda Hagedorn, Brian Benkin, and Veronica Lorson Fowler. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And while you are on our website, click the KHOI Auction House at the top left of the screen. There are many interesting artworks from Jean Coop Writing and Eric Celine and other artists, one-of-a-kind jewelry pieces, a handmade quilt by Greta Anderson. There's a bidding war for that, but it's still a bargain for such a beautiful quilt, and many other unusual and remarkable items. This is a great place to find unusual gifts for Christmas. I have a couple of items that were gifts from my son visiting his wife's family in the Philippines. One is a necklace and bracelet of seed pearls, and the other is a green necklace, which I've been calling a jade necklace, but in all honesty, I doubt that it's true jade, but it would certainly look great on a black dress. Do check it out at the green KHOI Auction House button on our website. There's not much time. The auction ends October 18th. Local Talk was produced by Susan Franzen. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Yankee Doodle by the U.S. Army Band. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At the top of the hour. Morning Masterpieces will follow at 9 a.m. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Convicted of a felony? Would you like to vote in Iowa? Now you probably can. On August 5th, the law in Iowa changed. That means most Iowans convicted of a felony can now vote. As long as you've discharged your sentence, including probation, parole, supervised release, and special sentence. Find out more at youcanvoteiowa.org. That's youcanvoteiowa.org.